Jesus' amazing prophecy. Mr. Clyde Snowden.
Good evening, everyone. The subject that is before you on the screen was not my subject. As a matter of fact, for those of you who have had a look at our schedule, I'm here this evening due to a trade with Jeff Hibbs, who did my subject that I was really happy with about 3 weeks ago on Nebuchadnezzar's image, and I have a great overhead on Nebuchadnezzar's image. Well, Jeff did just fine, but he wasn't able to be with us this evening. So I thought, well, Jesus' amazing prophecy. What were you going to talk about, Jeff? What was Jesus' amazing prophecy? Sometimes it's nice to get kind of a little insight into what you were going to talk about. He said, well, I'm sure it's the Olivet prophecy. Now, that's what we read tonight from Mark chapter 13. And that piece of prophecy, which was given by Jesus, is in three of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Matthew 24, and Mark 13, and Luke 21. And it is there in essence with some slight variations in each gospel. But certainly the essence of it is there. So we've got actually three words in our title. One is prophecy, which we want to talk about in a general sense this evening because it's Jesus' prophecy we're talking about. The other term, of course, is Jesus. And we've thrown the word in the middle, amazing, in because, I think what we're going to talk about tonight, even though I'm quite overwhelmed, I must say, by this whole topic, because sometimes we look at something all of our life and think, oh, I know all about that, and the Olivet prophecy, that's no problem at all. I probably got that on a CD somewhere. The fact is, friends, that Bible prophecy is really amazing because as the president and I were discussing before we opened this evening, we're never really quite through. As much as we think, as much as we think we know, and as we read and we study, we're never really quite through. Now, it turns out that in my preparation, my panic, actually, to prepare for what I want to say this evening, I read a whole book. That's how I got into it. I had to read the book because I had to understand what the writer was saying. I didn't agree with him, but that was fine because a lot of the time we read things that we don't agree with, but at least it helps us to understand what we do believe in and what we do agree with. So to begin with, I want to just talk about prophecy. Now, and if we talked about basic Bible prophecy, there are some facts that we need to remember. Much of the Bible, of course, is prophecy. Now, what we refer to as prophecy might determine whether 60% of the entire Bible is prophecy or whether only 50% or whatever. But certainly a very large percentage of the Bible is just straight prophecy. In Amos chapter 3 and verse 7, this verse appears, and it doesn't really appear anywhere else quite like this in Scripture, but it's certainly a significant verse to help us to understand what the purpose of prophecy is about. Surely the Sovereign Lord, and I'm taking my quotes from the New International Version, does nothing without revealing his plans to his servants, the prophets. Now, I think this is an underlying fact about prophecy in the Bible. It's there because it is God's way of communicating with his people. Now, God's people are not just the people of Israel. Certainly the people of Israel, the Jews, are God's people, as defined in the Bible. We're going to talk about that this evening quite a bit. But all people on the face of the earth are God's people in the larger sense. And God is communicating to the world through his prophets, who for the most part were Jews, about his plan. And so nothing really that is going to happen or has happened in the world has been done sort of in a corner without some witness by God, without some message. And the Bible that we have, most of us have in our hands this evening, is the primary source of that information. So prophecy is so that God can reveal his purpose and his plans through his servants, the prophets. There are two significant verses in the 18th chapter of Deuteronomy, and I've just put these up on the overhead so that we don't have to go and look at the 18th chapter of Deuteronomy. But there's a conflict about the authority of Moses. And these two statements are made by God. Deuteronomy 18 and verse 18. I will raise up from there for them a prophet like you. That is Moses. God is talking to Moses. I will raise up from them, that is the nation of Israel, a prophet like you, Moses, from among their brothers. I will put my words in his mouth, and he will tell them everything I command him. Now, you could take that as a little prophecy, isn't it? And the fact that God is saying, I'm going to do this in the future. You could actually apply this to hundreds of prophets that came to the people of Israel in their Old Testament and even their New Testament existence. There were lots of prophets, sort of like Moses. Verse 22 says, if what a prophet proclaims in the name of the Lord does not take place or come true, that is a message the Lord has not spoken. That prophet has spoken presumptuously. Do not be afraid of him. Now, first of all, in Deuteronomy 18 and 18, there is no doubt by Bible students that what is ultimately being referred to here is the coming of Jesus or the coming of the Messiah of Israel, who would be the greater prophet, who would be a prophet like unto Moses, but greater. Who would reveal to his people Israel everything that needed to be communicated to them. Now, the big problem in verse 22 is, how do you believe a prophet? How do you know what the prophet's saying is true? In that chapter in Mark that we read, it talked about all sorts of people saying all sorts of different things and deceiving people and prophets arising in the name of the prophet and the name of the Messiah and so on. And this was something that was a common occurrence, obviously, throughout the history of Israel. There were times when it was more intense than others. So who did you believe? Well, it's quite clear that what the prophet said had to have some type of immediate fulfillment. Now, when we say immediate fulfillment, I'm not sure whether that was like in the next hour or two. Sometimes it happened within an hour or two. Sometimes it was a year. And I suppose if a prophet made a significant prophecy and it happened within a year, that would be good enough for most people who heard it. They'd still be alive in a year and would say, well, what he said came true, and so therefore we better listen to this prophet. If it doesn't happen, that's the other problem here, isn't it? Because what would you do, wait for 10 years to see whether it happened or whether it didn't? It had to be fairly immediate. I think that's what is being said in Deuteronomy chapter 18. Otherwise, we would just go our way and say, oh, well, we don't have to bother with it. 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. I think we can probably demonstrate from the scriptures, and we'll give you some reason for that this evening, that it was often very, very quick. There is one account in the prophecy of Jeremiah of a false prophet that came along, and Jeremiah pronounced his death. And I think it was a matter of months before he actually died. So there was a good indication of how the true prophet, who was Jeremiah, prophesied against the false prophet, who was a gentleman by the name of Hananiah, that he would die because of a false prophecy that he had made, and it happened in a couple of months. So that seems to me to be pretty short witness to the prophecy. So they could say, well, Jeremiah's right, because what he said came true, and the other guy died, so what he said didn't come true. So two things from Deuteronomy 18. One is that there would be many prophets to come, and number two, from that, that there had to be some type of way of proving that the prophet was true, and that was by making sure that there was something that he said that was quite specific, that was not going to be something that could be subject to happenstance or chance or some development of man or some trick or whatever, but had to have some type of miracle attached to it, something that really wasn't definable in the normal sense of the word. Going back to verse 18, ultimately, we all agree that Jesus is the prophet that is being spoken about here in the prophecy in Deuteronomy 18, verse 18. Well, that's just fundamental to our understanding of Bible prophecy. It's God's way of speaking to the people. There were prophets that rose up throughout the history of the Jewish nation, and the main ones are in the Bible, who would have God's word put into their mouth, and God would communicate through them to his people. And thirdly, that there had to be some application. There had to be some fulfillment that the people who heard the prophet could say, he's right, it happened. And it follows that if it didn't happen, well, they could say, we don't have to worry about that. Somebody came along and pronounced doom and said, the sky's going to fall or whatever, and it didn't happen. Well, they could say, we don't have to worry about that prophet. If, however, the prophet came along and said something and it did happen quickly, then it was time to listen. Some more things to remember about prophecy. All Bible prophecy had to be for immediate consumption. And I think when we read through the chapters in the Old and the New Testament, the prophecy that's given was given for people for various reasons, but certainly it had to have hearers, current hearers to that prophecy that was given. It had to have some meaning to them of the day. It started off there. And very often, that situation where the prophecy was given and there were hearers to hear it, that became kind of the format for that prophecy throughout time. All prophecy has to fit the biblical outline and be in accordance with God's plan. So if some prophet came along and said something that didn't make any sense in relation to the rest of the Bible, well, that wouldn't be a prophet from God. And there were prophecies given by various prophets recorded in the Bible who said things that were completely outside of the will of God. So the prophecy, first of all, had to have some application to the people that were hearing it. It had to fit with the general outline of God's word. It also had to fit within the immediate context of the passage. Now, for example, we read tonight Mark chapter 13. And it's a chapter. It is a prophecy. It is a message that has a beginning and it has an ending. You'll see, as I said before, a similar prophecy in Matthew 24 and again in Luke 21. Those were prophecies that were set within a context, a biblical context. So when Jesus was talking to his disciples about these horrendous things that were coming, are going to come upon them and upon the nation of Israel, it had a current application. He was right within the bit of history that was unfolding in that way. And it was within the passages before and after. Now, I'm going to say that as far as I am personally concerned, and I think given another few evenings, I could probably demonstrate this quite well from the scriptures, that many Bible prophecies, and I'm going to change that word to most Bible prophecies, have many applications. Now, sometimes we get caught up in prophecy and say, well, this happened and that was that, and here's the history, and 508 BC at 10 o'clock in the morning in the month, whatever, that's it. And I think we make a big mistake when we do that. Bible prophecy has been written in such a way that it has, in most cases, timeless applications. Now, there are a number of reasons for that. One is because human nature is so predictable. People are so predictable. And the way we do things is so predictable. So therefore, if a prophet came along with a message for a population, you could probably take that and apply it over and over and over again for thousands of years because we are so predictable as people. The other reason for that is because God has an eternal plan. And he has that plan with his people Israel. And he's working out that plan with his people Israel. And they also, like everyone else on earth, are very, very predictable. So therefore, if you've got Israel and you've got Jews and you've got the city of Jerusalem and you've got the Sea of Galilee and the Jordan River and the Dead Sea and those types of geographical locations, and you've got a people that call themselves Israel, and they're living in that land of Israel, and they're doing things good or bad, you could probably take Bible prophecies from the beginning and apply them over and over again to those civilizations. I think we can be absolutely sure that most Bible prophecies have many applications. And I think we can be sure when we say that they apply in detail. Now, sometimes thinking that through is a bit of a challenge to us, as I've had with this. I've already mentioned to you the research on making this presentation. If Jesus made amazing prophecies that were fulfilled to the utmost detail, to the exact detail, then what are the implications of that in relation to taking that prophecy and applying it today, for example? It's an interesting question. Well, just a bit of a side issue. Bible prophecy has a twofold purpose. One is for, we use the word forthtelling, which means to warn people. As Amos chapter 3, verse 7 said, as we've already looked at, it's there to correct people, to straighten them out, to give them some insight into how to live a better life and what the implications of that might be if they don't. It's for foretelling, which means it's foretelling God's purpose in advance. And that's not just confined or restricted to his people Israel. That is for all mankind, and we can certainly demonstrate that from the Bible as well. Now, Jesus made many prophecies. He was, as we've already said, the one like Moses. Jesus prophesied his own death, and interestingly, he did it in Mark, the Gospel of Mark, three times. And perhaps you can just open up to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 8 and verse 31. And these are the types of things, I guess, when we read through the Bible, we can sometimes miss, because we see chapters in isolation. We don't see them as sort of a total message. Mark chapter 8 and verse 31. He then began to teach them, that is Jesus, began to teach his disciples and the people that were with him, that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. Verse 32 says, in the New International Version, he spoke plainly about this. So here he is, many months, but certainly not many years, before his actual crucifixion, walking along with his apostles and giving them the details of what was going to happen in Jerusalem to him. Chapter 9, verse 31. And here they had left that place and passed through Galilee, and Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were because he was teaching his disciples. He said to them, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. There's a detail right there. Going to be betrayed. There's going to be a betrayal that would happen. And so betrayal really means somebody of your own, the followers, you know, betrays you or hands you over. So there's going to be a betrayal. They will kill him, and after 3 days, he will rise again. But they did not understand what he meant and were afraid to ask him about it. And sometimes I think we can understand what they were afraid of, because sometimes the truth is not something we really want to know. And they had a problem with that because they were living with a great delusion, these apostles, 2,000 years ago, walking along the road with Jesus. They were actually delusional, as many other people of the day were. They thought that the Messiah of Israel, who they were concerned was Jesus, was going to take on the Roman army, kick the Roman occupation out, and reestablish the throne of David in Jerusalem. And that's what they'd been taught since they were children. That was the prevailing wisdom of the day in Judea and in the city of Jerusalem and in and around the temple that was the center of Jewish worship. They had no concept at all that the Messiah was going to die. Not that it wasn't prophesied in detail in their Old Testament scriptures. It's just that they just had no concept of it at all. So, secondly, 3rd Mark 10, verse 32. They were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way. And the disciples were astonished. And in verse 33, he said, we are going up to Jerusalem. So it's another little piece of information here. And the Son of Man will be betrayed. They already had that bit. To the chief priests and teachers of the law. Another little bit of information. And they will condemn him to death and hand him over to the Gentiles. All little bits of information that actually happened in detail with the crucifixion of Jesus. The Jews conspired after the betrayal of Judas, his own disciple, but weren't able to crucify Jesus, so handed him over to the Romans, who had the legal authority to do the deed. And they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. Specific details that were going to take place within months. 3 days later, he will rise. 6 or 8 specific details, prophecies that all happened in detail. And these were weeks and months, these prophecies, in terms of when they were made and when they're going to be fulfilled. And we got one better than that in Mark chapter 11. I believe it's here. The next day they were leaving Bethany, which is a little, kind of a little bedroom community outside of Jerusalem. And Jesus was hungry, and seeing in the distance a fig tree and leaf, he went and found no fruit. Now, we don't want to get into this one in any depth this evening, but the fig tree was highly symbolic in the Old Testament, and within the lore, if you like, of the Jewish nation, was highly symbolic of the Jewish nation. So there was lots of fig trees, as there were lots of olive trees, but specifically the fig tree had been mentioned in a number of Old Testament prophecies. So the Jewish people had this kind of affinity with the fig tree. So when Jesus actually comes up to the fig tree and says, looks at it and it's got leaves, but there's no fruit. It wasn't the season for figs, the Bible goes on to say. He says to the fig tree, he curses it basically and says, may no more, verse 14, may no one ever eat fruit from this tree again. And his disciples heard him say it. Here's a specific prophecy of Jesus. It was amazing because in verse 20, in the morning, this is the next day, and probably no more than 12 or 14 hours later, as they went along, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots, was dead from the roots up. And Peter remembered, and Peter said, Rabbi, look, the fig tree you cursed has withered. And that's short-term fulfillment. That's quick. So we know that if this man that we're listening to said the fig tree is going to be withered, and the next morning it was, then you needed to pay attention. You needed to remember the other things that he said, too, that were about to happen, and so on. So Jesus made amazing prophecies. There was quick fulfillments of Jesus' prophecies. So if they thought about it, they would have to say that this was a prophet like unto Moses, and the things that he was saying were actually coming true in exact detail. And it wasn't, of course, until after the crucifixion itself that the disciples were able to sit down and count up all these details and say, yes, that's exactly what he said. And so that was the proof to them that everything else that Jesus said was going to be true, because he said a whole lot more. And let's just back up just for a minute and just consider some facts about the time of Jesus. The nation of Israel was God's light-bearing nation. They were, at that moment in time, 2,000 years ago, defying the greatest nation that had ever existed. With the most well-organized society, the most well-organized mechanisms of war that had ever existed. This was the greatest world empire since the beginning of time. God's light-bearing nation was defying this nation of Rome because they had a misguided idea about their dominion over the earth. That is to say, the Jews felt that the capital of the world should be in Jerusalem, not in Rome. And that they had a God-given mandate to drive out all of the oppressors and the heathen, that the pagans and the Gentiles that had come into Jerusalem and into Judea, drive them out and set up God's kingdom. Now, there was a throne, the throne of David, that had fallen down, and one day it would rise again. But it would be according to God's plans and God's purpose, not these folks who happened to be running the city of Jerusalem in the time of Jesus. So this light-bearing nation was no longer sending forth God's light to the world. As a matter of fact, the nation was in a real desperate situation. There were 5 or 6 or 8 factions. Actually, the city of Jerusalem and the nation of Judea at the time of Jesus was involved in a civil war, a brutal civil war. And it was only because of the Roman occupation that they were kept apart to the extent that there wasn't just all-out civil war. So anarchy and civil war were basically brewing under the surface in Jerusalem and in Judea at the time of Jesus. God had sent the Messiah in the form of his son, Jesus Christ, to be the Savior of Israel. He came, as the Bible said, to his own. But his own didn't receive him. That is to say, those people who were running the city of Jerusalem and running the nation of Israel at the time had their own ideas about who the Messiah would be and how this would all come about. And Jesus simply didn't fit into their plans. So because he challenged their worldview, they crucified him at the hands of the Romans. Now, there had been dozens and dozens and hundreds of prophecies in the Old Testament scripture that talked about the end of the age, the coming of God's judgments. And as I said before, most of these prophecies had multiple fulfillments because the nation of Israel had suffered at the hands of many nations before. The nation of Israel had suffered at the hands of the Syrian nation, the Assyrian nation, had suffered at the hands of the Babylonians, had suffered at the hands of the Greeks, had suffered at the hands of the Seleucids and so on, and were now suffering at the hands of the Romans. And every time you could see that happening, there was kind of a terminal thing that was going on, and the prophecies were outstanding continually, that there would be an end of the world, an end of the age. The Jews actually believed that their religious society, which involved animal sacrifices in the temple, would in fact be superseded when Messiah came, and that to them would be kind of a rollover from the old order of things under Moses' law and the new international world government of Messiah. So there were great conflicts here. Now, this end of the age was in fact approaching quickly. It was speeded up because these people who were waiting for the Messiah took the Messiah that God sent and crucified him. And in 40 years, the temple was destroyed, and the nation of Israel, 40 to 45 years, the nation of Israel was taken completely, removed completely from the land of Israel, as far as the Galilee in the north, down into the south, to the borders of Egypt, were completely removed. And the country was destroyed, scraped bare like a desert, for miles and miles and miles in every direction from the city of Jerusalem. This happened about 43 to 44 years after Jesus' amazing prophecies. God, the God of Israel, was, while Jesus was ministering, assembling his army. And it is interesting that in the Old Testament that these armies that destroyed Israel were considered to be God's armies because they came to do God's will. In removing Israel, the Babylonians did it. To removing Israel because they'd failed to give forth the light that God had wanted them to. This nation of Rome was not just the occupying power, but was the power that was going to reluctantly, and I think I need to say that in all fairness, was going to reluctantly scrape the land of Israel bare. And the end of the nation would come. The end of the world would come. The end of the age would come. Luke chapter 19 and verse 41, or perhaps you could just flip over to that with me. Jesus' amazing prophecies, we could have said, because he made a lot of specific ones outside of the confines of those three chapters in the Gospels, Mark 13, Matthew 24, and Luke 21, that we refer to as the Olivet prophecies. He made a number of other ones. In Luke 19 and verse 41 is one such prophecy. The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. All right, so the days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. Now, this was spoken in the context of Jesus entering the temple with great, into the temple area and into Jerusalem with great fanfare. And you can read about this in the earlier verses in Luke chapter 19. But we don't want to go into that because we haven't got time to do that tonight. But the specific prophecy that came out of this was this utterance here. Now, in AD 70, and we're not going to do all the history here, and we might mess it up a bit and mix it up a bit, but in AD 70, General Titus, the Roman general, was trying to take over the city of Jerusalem and put down for once and for all a horrendous civil war and a horrendous problem that he was having with the Jews. His father, Vespasian, had had the problem before, and another Roman general had some problems 4 or 5 years before that when they'd actually gone in and tried to take Jerusalem, but the Jews were so violent that the Roman army withdrew. And when the Roman army was withdrawing, this is about AD 63, the Jews actually chased them and killed about 10,000 Roman soldiers, which really got the Romans angry. There is every evidence that the Romans didn't really want to bother with Jerusalem and the Jews, but they had no choice. The days will come, said Jesus, when your enemies... Now, this is to a crowd of people who had just proclaimed him as the king coming into the city, putting palm branches on the road as he rode in and throwing their garments on the road, saying, blessed is the king who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest. And Jesus' response to that was, the days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side and will dash you to the ground, you and your children within your walls. Titus, in AD 70, held a war council. He was so frustrated with this amazing resistance that he was getting from the Jews, had a war council to try and figure out if he could get some ideas about what to do with the Jews. He felt the only way to prevent the Jews from getting new supplies and continuing to resist was to completely cut them off. The Jews were bringing in supplies and keeping this siege going. So he had his soldiers build a siege wall totally encompassing the city. The wall was 4.5 miles around, completely encircling the city. There were 13 large forts outside. And evidently, as far as we can see from reasonably reliable historical sources, the Roman army completed this whole project in 3 or 4 days. That is what history tells us. It is said that in order to construct the walls and the forts, that all woodlands were cleared over about 60 square miles. They just denuded the landscape in Judea and brought all this material in and built this big embankment, rampart, leaving the country basically, as we said, a desert. The days will come upon you, Jesus said, about 40 years earlier, when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side and dash you to the ground. This was part of Jesus' amazing prophecy about what was going to happen to his nation. Now in Mark chapter 13, the disciples, of course, had this ongoing question, nagging question about what was going to happen, because they were waiting for this big event of the king of Israel. Now, the temple that they worshipped at was built by Herod, who happened to be an Edomite or an Idumean. It took 40 years to build. And there were massive stones in this building. Some of this is still evident today. You can see it in Israel. There were limestone slabs. They were massive. It was a massive building. It would have been considered one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world, this great building. And I guess it's sort of like me after I got off of a 767 a few years ago, looking at the plane saying, wow, look at that. How did that stay up? And it's amazing, that machine. They looked at these stones and were just going, wow, this is these huge stones there. What massive stones, what massive buildings. And Jesus said, well, you have a look at them, but they're not going to be there long because the time is coming when not one stone will be left upon another. It will not be thrown down. Disciples, of course, couldn't probably imagine such a thing. Josephus, the Jewish historian, said that some of the largest of these stones were 44 foot six long, or 30 cubits long. They would have weighed 100 tons each. They were massive stones. Now, unfortunately, you can't see this part of this picture here, but at the bottom of this wall, this is part of the wall of the foundation of the ancient Temple Mount, this wall that they uncovered is crushed in. It's actually caved in because of the massive weight of these stones being pushed off over the edge and coming down and crushing the road underneath that was all built out of stone. These massive stones, within 40 years, were all pushed off, all level, just pushed level. There's an arch in Rome called the Arch of Titus. It's at one of the entrances, I think, beneath the east side of the Colosseum. And it chronicles in sort of vast relief the horrible event of the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Here's the menorah candlestick being carried out by either slaves, probably slaves. They brought the treasure of the temple, some of it, back to Rome. And again, I don't want to take any more time on the horrific destruction of this. Well, this looks like fun, doesn't it? See it, that's my problem. Anyway, let's forget it. I also want to make another point as we wrap this up this evening, that much of what Jesus had to say in these prophecies, in Matthew 24 and Mark 13 and Luke 21 and many of the other prophecies that he gave, the ideas and the phrases came directly out of the Old Testament scripture. Now, if you have time, and I obviously can't throw this slide up because there's some glitch here. I was taking the notes of the church board meeting for my first time a week ago, and we were halfway through and the screen just went blank, so we had nothing, right? There was no record. So maybe I need a new laptop. The seventh chapter of Jeremiah has many allusions to the end of the age and the destruction of the nation of Israel. If you have time, I recommend that you read the seventh chapter of Jeremiah and read Matthew 21, 22, and 23. There are all sorts of phrases. Jeremiah 7 and 2, stand in the gate of the Lord's house. Jesus goes up and stands in the temple gate. Jeremiah 7 and 11, in this house, it had become a den of robbers, in their eyes. And Jesus said, my house you have made a den of thieves. Jeremiah chapter 7 verse 20, mine anger shall be poured out, it shall burn and shall not be quenched. Verse 7 of Matthew 22, sends forth his armies and burn their city. Verse 29 of Jeremiah 7, the Lord has rejected and forsaken the generation of his wrath. Matthew chapter 24 verse 34, you generation of vipers, said Jesus, this generation shall not pass till all these things have been fulfilled. And so on, dozens and dozens in Jeremiah chapter 7. And we could do that with chapter after chapter after chapter in the Old Testament scriptures. Jesus' words were dripping with phrases from the Old Testament, talking about this great event that was going to come upon the nation of Israel. the great destruction that was going to come upon the nation of Israel. And detail after detail of what Jesus said came true. In one of the accounts of the Olivet Prophecy that were given in response to the disciples' questions about when is these things going to happen and when is this all going to take place, Jesus said to the, as a warning to the Christians who would have been in Jerusalem at the time of this great disaster, he said, "You pray that your flight will not be in the winter," which is understandable, because it would have been much more difficult to get out of Jerusalem in the winter when it was colder. He said, "You pray that your flight won't be on the Sabbath day." And many people have said, well, that's because, you know, some people who believe that we should be still keeping the Sabbath said, well, that's because the Christians weren't supposed to do anything on the Sabbath day. But in fact, Jerusalem was a Jewish city at the time, and they locked the gates of the city on the Sabbath day. That was the habit of the nation of Israel. So if you wanted to get out of the city because of this great horrendous thing that was happening, you better hope it wasn't on the Sabbath day, because the gates were all locked and you couldn't get out. So detail after detail after detail, Jesus provided about this horrendous event that was about to come upon the nation. I believe that everything that was said in Matthew 13 that we read, that everything that was said in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21, the parallel sort of passages that were said by Jesus in this amazing prophecy, happened. All of those things were fulfilled in detail. And it would take a whole other study to go through verse by verse and analyze each one of those statements to prove that point. It all happened. It all came true exactly as Jesus said it would. Let's go to Luke 21 as we sort of bring this to a conclusion. Many people argue that some of this prophecy sort of related to that horrendous event in the first century. And somewhere along the line, it suddenly relates to the future, you know, sort of like it's split in pieces. I don't believe that's true at all. I believe, as I've already said, it all happened in one way or the other, in detail, in the first century. But however, by the time you get through reading this passage, you have to come to the understanding that it isn't complete. There's something still outstanding. And I suggest that we need to understand that it's all outstanding. It's all potentially there to happen again, if the right conditions are there. Now, in verse 20 of Luke 21, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, you know that its desolation is near. Let those who are in Judea, excuse me, flee to the mountains, let those in the city get out, and so on, and let those who are in the country not bother going back into the city. There were specific times when Jesus made these prophecies that if the people watched what was going on in this time of great tribulation in Jerusalem, they were cues for them to get out of the city. And in fact, they did. Most of the Christians fled out of the city and went across the Jordan River to a place called Pella in Edom and were spared. There were virtually no Christians in the city when this happened. But my point here, friends, is this, that if we have situations like this that exist in the future, now for 2,000 years there was no Israel. There was no Jews in Jerusalem. There was no nation. If we have, because these prophecies, I believe, happened over and over again, if we have conditions that are conducive to these things happening again, then we need to understand that Jesus' amazing prophecy applies to us today. I suggest to you that all prophecy is relevant to today. We can take it all and say there is truth in all of this in relation to the world in which we live. And let's look at verse 24 of Luke chapter 21. They shall fall by the sword and be taken as prisoner, and to all the nations, Jerusalem shall be trampled on by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. There was to be no Jews in Jerusalem for some great long period of time. And I'm sure that what Jesus is saying here, and Christadelphians believe this, that when Israel starts coming back to its land and there's a new presence of Israel in the land, especially if that nation is not a godly nation, and is equally as fractured as the nation was in Jesus' day, then all prophecy is once again relevant. Israel is still God's nation. Verse 28 of Luke 21. When these things begin to take place, stand up and lift up your heads because your redemption is drawing near. And that was certainly true in AD 70. But it's also true today because the Bible, in all of its prophecies, continues to speak about the time of the end. The world is going to end, and God is going to set up a kingdom on this earth. It's going to be the throne of David reestablished, and Jerusalem is going to be the capital. Israel is still God's nation and is in need of redemption. And as long as Israel is in need of redemption, as long as the throne of David has not been reestablished, all these prophecies, I believe, are relevant. The Messiah of Israel has not yet returned to establish the throne of David. And the New Testament prophecies and the words of Jesus himself indicate that he will. The New Testament prophecies of Jesus indicate that there will be a time of the Gentiles. Paul, a writer in the New Testament in the book of Romans, says that those times of the Gentiles will also come to an end. They will be fulfilled, and at that time all Israel will be saved. Our appeal is that we will continue to look at these prophecies, understanding that God's plan is working out. It is not fully worked out yet. There is a time of the end that is coming upon this world that we live in. And many of the signs that we didn't have time to look at in this amazing prophecy of Jesus are starting to be fulfilled in the day in which we live. Our whole world is living in the shadow, basically, of the amazing prophecies of Jesus. He has one final thing to say. Jesus has one final thing to say. And that is what he said to his disciples in the first century. It's the same thing he says to us in the year 2007. He says, I tell everyone to watch. That's what his instruction to us is, to watch and to continually look at these things and understand that his prophecies are relevant, they apply to today, and that the outcome of this is going to be the redemption of the world and also your redemption and mine.